Welcome back to Red Ice Radio. Thank you for being here. I'm Henrik, and I hope you're having a good day and a good start to this June 2015. For newcomers, our website is redicecreations.com, where you can find a lot more of what we do, news, radio, videos, and more. We also have redicecreations.net, direct access to the radio archive, and redicemembers.com for our subscribers who enjoy getting the full broadcast and all the other members' content. We have Jim Fetzer with us today, a first-time guest, and also returning with us on the program is Ulle Damegård once again. Mr. Fetzer is a former Marine Corps officer and McKnight Professor Emeritus at the University of Minnesota, Duluth. He has published widely on the theoretical foundations of scientific knowledge, computer science, artificial intelligence, cognitive science, and evolution and mentality. Well, I think you guys and gals know Ulle Damegård by now if you are regular listeners, but for any newcomers, let me just mention that Ulle is an author, international speaker, investigator, former journalist, and artist who has spent at least 25 years investigating a multitude of conspiracies. He's behind the website Light on Conspiracies. And we are going to stay in the topic of conspiracy and cover-up today. We have an interesting program ahead on a new book of theirs called And I Suppose We Didn't Go to the Moon Either. It's a collection of essays that is intended to challenge some of our most cherished and deeply held beliefs. Let me just read a portion here to you before we get to our guests. This book demonstrates with scientific argument and empirical proof that man did not go to the moon, that Paul McCartney was replaced after his death in 1966, and that the official narrative of the Holocaust cannot be sustained. It also explains how and why the United States hung one of its doubles, not the real Saddam Hussein, and that Osama bin Laden was not killed by U.S. Navy SEALs in Pakistan in 2011, but died from his medical conditions in 2001, where it was politically expedient for him to die a second time. Welcome, gentlemen. It's great to have you both here. And obviously, Ulle, you're a returning guest. We've had you many times now. As always, though, it's always great to have you with us. Welcome back.
Thank you so much, Henrik.
And, of course, we have with us Jim Fetzer as well. First time we have you on the program. It's good to have you here. Thank you for coming on.
Well, I've heard so many good things about Red Ice Radio, Henrik. I'm delighted to be here.
Thank you so much. Great to hear it. I mean, you've been, of course, doing what you've been doing for a long time. It's good to finally have you here, connect with you, and I'm looking forward to speaking more about your work as well, Jim, here. But as a way of kind of beginning this program here, why don't we just kind of start with you, Jim, before we dive into the book. I want to hear a little bit more about you. I know that you're a former Marine Corps officer. You were a professor at the University of Minnesota, Duluth. How did you end up writing on the subjects we'll speak more about here today?
Yes, I graduated from Princeton magna cum laude in philosophy and was commissioned a second lieutenant in the Marine Corps. I resigned my commission after 4 years as a captain to enter graduate school and earn my PhD in the history and the philosophy of science. And from 1970 to 2006, I taught at a wide range of colleges and universities around the country, principally courses in logic, critical thinking, and scientific reasoning. I became very interested in JFK in 1992 when I discovered that the editor-in-chief of the Journal of the American Medical Association was attacking everyone who'd ever done serious work on the assassination, many very prominent figures. And I knew that he was thereby abusing his position as an editor, where I had a great deal of editorial experience myself. I was 10 years an associate editor with Synthes, a very famous international journal for epistemology, methodology, and the philosophy of science. I would subsequently found my own journal, an international journal for artificial intelligence, philosophy, and cognitive science entitled Minds and Machines. So it was very clear to me that this was an abuse, and it struck me that if someone of his degree of prominence were to be politically abusing his position, perhaps some of us with special backgrounds and abilities ought to become involved in research here. I contacted a fellow who'd authored a letter to the American Medical Association, to the journal known colloquially as JAMA, J-A-M-A, where I liked what he had to say. He had both a PhD and an MD. It turned out in physics, MD, and he was board certified in radiation oncology, which, of course, is a treatment of cancer using X-ray therapy. His name is David W. Mantic, and I suggested to him that we collaborate on a long article or a short book. Several others joined us, including a world authority on the human brain, who is also an expert on wound ballistics. A PhD in physics from Australia, who is an expert in electromagnetism, the properties of light and images of moving objects, a physician who'd been present in trauma room one when JFK was brought in, and then 2 days later was responsible for the treatment of his alleged assassin, Lee Oswald, the legendary photo and film analyst. We redid the case from the bottom up, went back to the official X-rays and the autopsy report and so forth, and discovered the X-rays had been altered, the autopsy report had been revised, that they'd even substituted someone else's brain, because once they patched up a fist-sized hole in the back of JFK's head, there was nowhere for those brains to go. I could have drawn that conclusion because it's a virtually intact brain when JFK had about half his brains blown out in Dealey Plaza, but it was nice to come from a world authority on the human brain. I would wind up chairing or co-chairing 5 different national conferences on JFK, published my first book, a collection of expert studies, including by Mantic and others, including Bob Livingston, who was the world authority on the human brain, who was the scientific director of 2 institutes of the National Institute for Health, which are located across the street from Bethesda Naval Hospital. Really fascinating stuff. It's entitled Assassination Science 1998. I organized a conference in Minneapolis in 1999 on the death of JFK, published a second book entitled Murder in Dealey Plaza in 2000, and then had a conference on the Duluth campus about the Zapruder film specifically because we had so many indications the film had been massively revised, and that was published in the Great Zapruder Film Hoax in 2003.
Yeah,
I founded Scholars for 9/11 Truth in December of 2005. Henrik, and I don't know if the university would have been supportive in my research on 9/11 as it was on JFK, where I believe I had an advantage because there was a member of the graduate faculty, the administration, and the Twin Cities campus who really liked my work. So, you know, while many colleges and universities take a dim view of their faculty becoming involved in these complex and controversial issues, my opinion is nothing could be more appropriate.
Yeah,
and I think it was a rather natural extension of my research from that point on, especially on 9/11, but subsequently on Sandy Hook, on the Boston bombing, currently on Jade Helm, and where this book was kind of a natural extension, because so much of what we're dealing with here involves lies from the government, and some of the biggest lies we've heard from the government are ones that are addressed in this particular volume.
Well, exactly. The title is, and I suppose we didn't go to the moon either. So obviously, it's a collection of essays with a lot of different authors. You guys are editors, have been doing the layout, etc. And there's a lot of different topics in there. I don't know if it would be fair to kind of call it a one-stop shop of all the things we're not supposed to know about. But how did the book come together, guys? Whoever want to pick up on that.
Well, here's a nice summary from the back page that gives a theme of the book and some of the tenor. William Casey, director of the CIA, was reported to have told his staff, "Our disinformation campaign will be a success when everything the American people believe is false." And they seem to have done a pretty good job of it, where this book explains how we know that we did not go to the moon but faked it, that Paul McCartney died and was replaced, that we hung a double, not Saddam, that Osama died in Afghanistan, not Pakistan, that the Holocaust was different than historians claim, where this book challenges some of our most cherished and deeply held beliefs, but the authors have no axe to grind, and unlike the parties to these frauds, are only committed to exposing the truth.
Yeah.
To be more specific with you, Ole, Mike Palachek envisioned the having a series of books entitled Resist the Empire, Save the World, the first of which was a study of me and of Kevin Barrett, a colleague with whom I had a radio show on the Genesis Communication Network for a year and a half entitled The Dynamic Duo. So he used the title The Dynamic Duo And it turned out to be a monster book about the size of a small phone directory. But we wanted to do one also on Sandy Hook and the Boston bombing, both of which were elaborate frauds. Nobody died at Sandy Hook or at the Boston bombing. I've done a huge amount of research on this. That was actually originally intended to be published before this one, which leads to the title, and I suppose we didn't go to the moon either after learning that nobody died at Sandy Hook. But because of production problems on that book, this one has come out first and actually been beneficial because it enables me to re-edit the earlier book with much more recent and actually more important articles than many we had in the earlier version. And there will be a sequel here about the nuclear attack on New York on 9/11 because most Americans have no idea how it was done, who was responsible, or why. So the final volume in the four-book series will be on 9/11.
Very good. There's a lot of different topics here, obviously, to dive into and to talk more about. And obviously, the most controversial has to be the Holocaust issue, and I definitely want to talk more in detail about that a little bit later. But let's just kind of speak about the main subject first of the book, or I don't know if it is the main subject, but it's the first one, and it addressed in the title of the moon, of course. Just tell us when and how you first, Jim, and then we can switch over to Ulla, why this is a topic that deserves the title of the book, in your opinion, Jim.
Well, it's very interesting because in 2001, I had made my second trip to London and brought my wife. I'd been there before to give the keynote address at the annual meeting of the British Society for the Philosophy of Science at the London School of Economics. And I loved London so much, I knew Jan and Sarah would be thrilled. So next time I brought them with me, and Jan and I, her maiden name was Morgan. So when I was looking for a suitable place, I found on Bloomsbury Street the Morgan Hotel, which backs onto the British Museum. So I booked us there, and we were watching one of the BBC channels when, to my astonishment, they played conspiracy theory, did we land on the moon? And I was utterly captivated. I'd say from that point on, I took a keen interest. And on my own radio show, which was more recently on Revere Radio with 882-hour interviews on complex and controversial issues, I did several about the moon landings, including with Jay Wiedner, who, of course, is a contributor to the present book. And, you know, it was just a matter of putting all the pieces together where Winston Wu turns out to be an absolute genius in his analysis of the moon landing. And one of the key chapters there is by Winston entitled The Apollo Moon Hoax, 35 Proofs We Did Not Go. I would just add, Heinrich, that we have 100 pages on the moon landing. We have 100 pages on Paul McCartney, and the importance of that will emerge. Then we have 50 pages discussing Saddam Hussein and his replacement by a double, and another 50 on Osama and the faking of his second death in Pakistan. And then the final 50 pages are on the Holocaust, the mythology of World War II. And I must say, in my opinion, those are probably the 50 most powerful pages ever published on the Holocaust.
Interesting. Yeah, I definitely want to hear more about that. But maybe you want to, I mean, we've spoken, of course, about the moon issue, if you will, in the past, and many people have different opinions, different angles to this and whatnot. But tell us how you guys approached the subject. And again, there's so much to dive into. And so obviously at some point there's a selected material that you have to go for. So what give us some of the evidence that we didn't go to the moon?
Well, we can begin with, a vast number of anomalies in the moon photographs, the very existence of which is questionable in and of itself for multiple reasons. But where, for example, you find photographs with two sources of light, so shadows are cast in two different directions. You find the astronauts illuminated on the dark side of the moon lander, where they should be in the dark, but they're not. They're illuminated. We have moon rover photographs with no tracks in front or behind. So how did the moon rover get into that position? We have photographs of the moon lander after it's landed, but there's no blown out dust beneath the jets, which would have invariably occurred had it actually come down as claimed, and no dust on the landing pods either. I mean, there's a whole lot more, but that'll give you just an inkling of the idea of what we were uncovering. Well, which includes, by the way, a fascinating calculation by Jack White. This was the celebrated film and photography expert who I became acquainted with. We became close colleagues in relation to JFK research, where he had discovered one oddity after another, and many indications that his Zapruder film had been altered, and the backyard photographs of Lee Oswald had been faked, and so forth. But here, in this instance, he had a website, which you can find online for, you know, Jack White's Apollo Moons photo studies. And one of the most interesting, apart from, you know, the detailed features of the specific photographs, is the following. He discovered, he added up how many photographs had been taken during the various moon landings, the 6, 11, 12, 14, 15, 16, and 17. And he found that altogether there were 5,771 photographs that had been taken in 4,834 minutes. Now, he wrote, if nothing but photography had been done, such a feat is clearly impossible, made even more so by all the documented activities of the astronauts. Imagine 1.19 photos every minute that men were on the moon. That's one picture every 50 seconds. The secret NSA tried to hide has been discovered. The quantity of photographs purporting to record the Apollo lunar EVAs could not have been taken on the moon in such an impossible time frame. So why did these photos exist? How did these photos get made? Did any men go to the moon, or was it truly the greatest hoax ever, where the other evidence we amassed together with this established that, without any doubt, it is the greatest hoax ever?
So let's speak about Wernher von Braun a little bit, because that obviously connects us with the whole, with the Second World War. He was shipped off to the USA after Germany had been destroyed. And so did he, how much would you say he contributed to the US space program? Obviously there's a difference here, meaning, it's not indicative of the fact that man didn't go into space, but it's a detail of whether, when and or even how we landed on the moon. Is that a correct assessment?
Yes, well, Werner was brought over to the U.S. as a part of Operation Paperclip, where many of the Germany's best scientists and intelligence officials were incorporated into the American intelligence establishment, where even NASA, it turns out, is apparently a branch of the CIA. Now, the United States had been embarrassed by Sputnik, where the Russians got a satellite into space ahead of the U.S., suggesting they had technological and scientific superiority. So JFK declared that we had the mission to put a man on the moon. Now, I believe that if JFK had lived and had been informed of the insuperable scientific obstacles, including, for example, the Van Allen radiation belt, where NASA has recently acknowledged that the greatest obstacle to a manned mission to Mars is overcoming the Van Allen radiation belt, which is fantastic. I mean, they issued this announcement on 30 August 2012, when the Van Allen radiation belt is nothing new. It's been here since Earth was formed. So, you know, I mean, the idea that if that would inhibit a manned mission to Mars, it would also inhibit a manned mission to the moon. So they didn't realize quite how much they were conceding. Now, Wernher von Braun became involved in all of this. He designed a spaceship to go to the moon that was like three times larger than the Empire State Building. And he said we'd need several of them. But I believe when it became technologically obvious, this was scientifically impossible, that he participated in the cover-up, including conducting a trip to Antarctica that appears to have been done to collect moon rocks that had been dislodged from Earth's surface by the impact of small asteroids and caught in the Earth's gravitational field, so that they were brought down into that region of Earth, so that they could actually produce rocks that were bona fide moon rocks. They simply hadn't got to Earth the way claimed aboard a spaceship. Those were conducted in the local summer of 1966-67, and appears to have been a part of it. But all the techniques that were used here to create the fakery were well captured in a number of films, but especially perhaps Capricorn 1, which was about faking a trip to Mars that includes several famous actors, including even O.J. Simpson before his disgrace over the murder of his ex-wife.
That's right.
And it showed the use of a very grainy single-source feed. I mean, all of this appears to have been done on a set. Stanley Kubrick appears to have created the images for use, and in return, he was given funding for his Space Odyssey 2001. Jay Wiedner has been right on top of this and published a marvelous article explaining how it was done using what is known as front screen projection.
Yep, exactly. I remember in, I think it was 2009, it came out that some of the moon rocks that was given to Holland, by the way, by Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin, turned out to be fake.
Yeah, it turned out to be a piece of petrified wood.
Yeah, interesting, huh?
But, that's so embarrassing and so amateurish. Would you believe now, NASA recently acknowledged that it had lost all of its original moon travel landing footage,
yes.
Which is astonishing. Yeah. I mean, you know, some 7 boxes, Heinrich. This had to be the most precious footage ever acquired by the hand of man, assuming, of course, that these trips actually took place. But I think it's very clear that in order for anomalies, you know, and the fakery of the footage to be discovered, they prefer to simply, you know, dispose of it, claim it was lost, which is utterly preposterous on the face of it. And I'm given to understand that they're going through and selectively deleting other moon landing photographs even as we speak.
Now, let me try to poke at this a little bit here and ask you guys how you explain the lunar laser ranging experiments and the alleged, because I haven't looked into this in much detail, to be honest, about this particular thing. But obviously, what we hear is that we had mirrors placed on the moon. There are distance measurements and these kinds of things made with lasers all the time. How is this explained?
By unmanned landings. I mean, there's no doubt we've sent lunar probes to the surface of the moon. No one was live aboard them to risk exposure to radiation, which the astronauts' spacesuits would not have prevented. They basically were costumes intended to create the impression. You can go back to, you know, all kinds of science fiction films and television programs we've had over the decades, and you'll see similarly flimsy costumes. So, you know, the reflections, I think, aren't in doubt, and that they were implanted by, you know, these unmanned landings, which may have landed robotic equipment there to emplace them. So that really is doubt, and most certainly does not show that man went to the moon.
Right. Okay, that's good. I want to make that distinction, because obviously it seems there's a lot of things that have been successful. But we're talking about probes and things like that, and it's a huge difference, as you say, to actually land a human being there, and the way it suggests that it was taken. I know that other people, too, have suggested that, we did go to the moon, but not in the way that we are told. Is that anything you guys touch
Heinrich,
upon?
Heinrich, it reaches a point of, it's what Imre Lakatos described as a degenerating research paradigm. You have a hardcore, and you want to defend it regardless, so you start jettisoning and replacing auxiliary hypotheses about the evidence and so forth. Well, yes, they faked all the photographs, but that's because they had to conceal something more important. We never know what it is that's more important. We are never provided with any proof that we actually went to the moon. And just to make an observation about the features, the gross features of the moon photographs, these cameras were situated on the front of the astronauts' suits. They could not even be focused or framed. They could certainly turn, point, and take. Now, under those circumstances, you'd expect a whole lot of photographs that would be out of focus or not properly framed and so forth. That's not what we have. Every single moon photograph seems somehow miraculously to have been properly framed, properly photographed, properly focused. One of the points that Jay Wiedner makes, of course, about the foreground and the background is ordinarily they would not both be in focus, and it's an indication of the use of front screen projection that you have the background in the distance just as sharply in focus as the foreground. My own opinion is cosmic rays would interfere with the photographic plates, and it would have been impossible to take any photographs on the moon. But the signs of, you know, that this was all fabricated and faked are simply overwhelming. And I don't think we can get away with some suggestion that it was, you know, actually they faked what they gave us to conceal what they didn't give us. You still can't overcome the insuperable objection posed even by the Van Allen radiation belt, which NASA itself has confirmed.
Ula, have you looked into this subject a lot yourself?
A lot, I wouldn't say so, but I've always been very interested because it's so clear, if you just look at it with a normal sense of logic, that once you look into the details and the evidence, there's something extremely wrong, and there's a lot of forgery going on. One thing that has really got me interested in this is that when I started out in the early 80s with these things, I had no idea that there were any type of connection between different assassinations or something. I thought they were totally separate things. But when you really go into deep into history, you will find that we have the same key players behind so many of these atrocities that the world have experienced, and the same key players like masters of manipulation. I mean, you've got Donald Rumsfeld, you've got Henry Kissinger, you've got the Bush family, the Dulles brothers. I mean, everything, they've been involved in everything from the fake Zimmerman telegram that got the U.S. into the First World War. That was Prescott Bush. Then you had Prescott Bush funneling a lot of the funds to Hitler. You had the Dulles brothers that was working at Wall Street lawyers, but working for Hitler. Then Alan Dulles was in charge or very involved in Operation Paperclip, where they exported all of these Nazi scientists and very, very skilled people in so many different areas, where these people were part of building up and creating what is now called NASA, or it was called that right away, but that was built up together with people from the OSS, later the CIA, Alan Dulles, and German scientists, among other things. They were also, as far as I've been able to find out, part of creating what is called the CDC. That was in 1946, the Center for Disease Control. And that is the one that is now so central every time they have one of these swine flu or the Ebola scare or whatever it is they're trying to scare the living bejesus out of it. They're using these organizations. And then you go through, you see the Kennedy assassination. We have the same players involved there, George Bush, the paymaster for Operation 40, which was deeply involved in the assassination, Alan Dulles, part of the planning and also part of the cover-up in the Warren Commission. Then it just goes on and on. You have the overtake of all of these countries in Latin America where Henry Kissinger and the creation of the Contras and the whole Iran-Contra scandal, same key players. You have Operation Phoenix in this assassination program in Vietnam. And all of it's the same people again and again and again and again and again and again. It's just like incredible. So I think one of the things that is so wonderful with these books is that they're putting it back together, showing that, listen, we're not living in a totally mad world. We're living in a world where there's hardly any evidence for real terrorism. We're living in a world where we're being totally manipulated on so many different layers and with so many different fake events. I mean, they're fake. So I think this is beautiful when they get exposed, because it's like it helps us take our power back, because we've lost it. We've given it up to this elite few, as they call themselves, and we're letting us be totally duped. So I think books like this, extremely important, even though we go right for in the belly of the beast, especially when it comes to the Holocaust thing, which is so many people have, or the people who have had the guts to expose these things, most of them have gone down in flames. Their career has been totally destroyed. They've ended up in jail. I mean, it's still like that. In some, you, Henrik, me, Jim, if we were in Germany now, we would be arrested. Or if this discussion or the programs that I was on before this book was published in Germany, we would go straight to jail. And Germany, of all countries, it's so absurd. The whole thing is so absurd.
Yeah, it certainly is. And I wanted to squeeze in, if you will. Well, we have plenty of time to go here in the first segment, of course, but I did want to get into the Holocaust here in the first segment so we can get to some of that, because it's just such an important area. It's very controversial, and some of the authors you feature in the book about this is, among others, Professor Robert Faurisson, for example, from France, I believe, and he has been, I mean, God, I looked at some footage the other day of him. He's gotten his, you know, face, you know, beat up, or beaten in, I guess that's the term, and some tremendous violence aimed at him for asking some of these questions. You feature Thomas Dalton, and Jim, tell us just when and how and why did you want to go into this particular area when there's so much controversy and so much anger and emotion and everything you can imagine around this topic?
Well, I first became serious about it when an associate of mine in Illinois proposed having a conference on academic freedom. Are there limits to inquiry? And we settled on JFK, 9/11, and the Holocaust as examples that would perfectly illustrate the situation, where most academicians are simply too timid. They want to avoid any form of embarrassment. They don't want a student to ask a question they can't answer. They don't want to be called out for something that they might regard as beyond their own competence. So they play it safe, and they just don't go there, which has led to the absurdity that the very faculty whose tenure ensures that they can tackle complex and controversial issues confronting society without fear of loss of their positions are nevertheless among the most timid and unwilling to explore these issues. In the setting up that conference, I made contact with several an attorney who is very active in First Amendment cases, a member of the AAUP who is outspoken in defense of academic freedom, and they wouldn't participate. They weren't willing to go there. They weren't willing to talk about these issues. So I became more deeply involved, and in the course of my research of preparing my own presentation, I discovered at that time that the number 6 million did not have an empirical or historical basis, but that there had been 236 references to 6 million Jews who were either in dire straits or in fear of their lives before the Nuremberg tribunals, beginning as early as 1890. Thomas Dalton has suggested there are some even before that point in time, but I presented a dozen or more examples during the conference, which was actually on the campus of the University of Illinois Champaign-Urbana. And when I returned from that, where Nicholas Kohlerstrom, by the way, who also contributed an article.
That's right.
Here,
I forgot. He's
published
great.
This brilliant new book called Breaking the Spell, participated with us on Skype, for example. And would you believe, when I returned home, I checked and my wiki entry had been gutted. It used to be very, very substantial. A tremendous amount about all my research on JFK, 9/11, the plane crash that took the life of Senator Paul Wellstone, Sandy Hook, the Boston bombing, claims I was anti-Semitic that I dispatched in an early article entitled "Is 9/11 Research Anti-Semitic?" and the like. And Heinrich, they've taken out 2/3 of the entry.
They've taken everything
about all my serious research on what is usually called conspiracies, but where really the label conspiracy theorist is used to try to categorize and dismiss serious critics of the government. I mean, most conspiracy theorists really fall into the category of being those who are exposing government lies. So the government has to take some action to defend itself in introducing a novel phrase or expression which originated with the CIA in response to criticism that was being directed at the Warren Commission. They devised this phrase, conspiracy theorist. On one interview I did with a major radio station, WCCO, in Minneapolis, on my way to a conference on JFK just this past year, I explained that better terms are conspiracy realist or even conspiracy analyst. But the fact of the matter is, we're simply critics of the government. We're exposing falsehoods and revealing truths, and the government does not like it. So, I mean, that's got a whole lot to do with what's going on here. Interestingly, I happen to have a recent copy of my Wikipedia entry. So I published an article about it entitled James H. James Henry Fetzer, Wikipedia, the Free Encyclopedia, Busted, where I published the current version that was edited after I participated in the Academic Freedom Conference and the original to show how much they had taken out. And although I encountered the bizarre experience a month or so ago of having 150 articles I'd published on Veterans Today deleted by the senior editor, deleted 150 articles I'd published there since 5 July 2011, because I was speaking out about Jade Helm and he wanted to suppress it. I nevertheless was able to reconstruct that article. I had a copy that had been published in toto on another website. So you can find it now several places, including my own personal blog, jamesfetzer.blogspot.com, and on the new website for veterans entitled veteranstruthnetwork.com. But if you want to see how Wikipedia functions as a Zionist political operation, while it's perfectly reliable on relatively routine or uncontroversial issues about science, history, the meaning of words, and so forth, it's twisted or perverted when it comes to politically controversial issues, as my case illustrates. Indeed, I mentioned that I founded Scholars for 9/11 Truth in 2005. Well, I discovered Wikipedia had entries about scholars that were grossly inaccurate. So I went onto Wikipedia. You know how they claim anyone can edit Wikipedia.
That's over.
I tried a half a dozen times to correct it, and every time I was rebuffed and it was reverted to the original.
Of course.
And I finally got into a chat with a person who was not allowing it. I said, "You're not going to let me correct this, are you?" And he said, "No."
Yeah.
So, I mean, it was just illustrative. I actually published an article about that, too. But I don't know if I have reconstructed it yet or not. But in any case, this is a highly illustrative case. And that reinforced my interest in the Holocaust. And I did more research on it. When Nick published, before he published his book, he invited me to write the preface to the book, which I was very honored to do. And I published it even as an independent article on Veterans Today. It's one of the 150 that's since been deleted. But in fact, I was able to recapture that too. And that's what you find in my contribution to part four on the Holocaust, where I'm summarizing not only that we have these 236 references to 6 million Jews in distress or in fear of loss of their lives before the Nuremberg Tribunal, but the fact that this whole number, 6 million, appears to be derived from a disputed passage in Leviticus that's been interpreted to mean that the chosen people can only return to the promised land when they're minus 6 million who have been consumed in the flames. And even that number requires an interpolation because there was no 6 million, numeral in the language in which it was originally written. So this is all a matter of interpretation or reconstruction. In fact, the International Committee of the Red Cross did very thorough, meticulous records. They were visiting all the camps, and they kept dates, cause of death for all the deaths. And in 1993, they updated, and their total was 296,081 that had died from all causes. In fact, it's interesting, Heinrich, more Catholics than Jews died in Auschwitz.
Yeah, wow. Well, I mean, when you go into this area, it's just you can't go in there. I mean, obviously, and if you do, your character needs to be destroyed at any means necessary. I mean, okay, there's one thing with the establishment, per se, and their view on this, and of course their mouthpieces, like the mainstream media and Wikipedia and all these sources. But from your audience point of view, Jim, I guess more just on a personal note, did people, were they angry and upset with you that you wanted to touch on this and this is like going too far, or were they willing to listen to what you had to say about it?
Oh, no. The book's been a huge success. Actually, believe it or not, Amazon has over 2 million books, and our book already is above 1,888 on their bestseller list in terms of number of volumes sold over a period of time. I think a lot of people recognize the importance of what we're doing for the following reason, Heinrich. What Nick did was to reveal scientific evidence that the Holocaust story of 6 million Jews being gassed to death in chambers using Zyklon B was unsustainable on the basis of laws of material science and of biochemistry. And because Nick is an historian of science, because my PhD is in the history and philosophy of science, I was very impressed. I have done a lot of work on the theoretical foundations of scientific knowledge, computer science, artificial intelligence, cognitive science, evolution and mentality, the nature of laws, the nature of scientific explanations, the nature of scientific reasoning generally. Any reasoning involving laws of science established by the different science, physics, chemistry, biology, and so forth is scientific reasoning. And in this case, what Nick discovered was that as a principle, a law of biochemistry, that bodies that die from cyanide poisoning, where Zyklon B is a form of cyanide, their bodies turn pink. And the walls of chambers where Zyklon B is used turn, because of the interaction with the elements in the wall, they turn blue. But we have no reports of pink bodies from any of the camps. We've never had them. And the only walls that turn blue were in chambers that were being used for delousing, which is something that was going on in the camps to keep the inmates well. It was a matter of hygiene and sanitation to keep diseases like typhus from spreading, which are done by body lice. So they used quite a copious quantity of Zyklon B, but it was for delousing, which led Nick to observe that the quickest way to lose your appointment at a British museum is to raise questions about the delousing technology used by the Germans in World War II.
Yeah.
Because he was booted out of University College London, where he'd had a post for some 11 years merely by publishing articles about objective scientific evidence that the official narrative of the Holocaust cannot possibly be true. And to make one terribly important observation, Gilad Otzman, whom I featured as the third of my speakers when I organized the first international conference for scholars for 9/11 truth at Friends House in London in 2010, has come here to Madison twice. He was here just a week or so ago, and it was my great pleasure to see him again. But when he visited here about a year ago, before I gave a talk about Jewish identity politics, and it struck me just unbelievably clearly how the Holocaust story has been used to play on a Western sense of guilt in order to manipulate these nations to giving Israel preference because they feel responsible for the death of 6 million Jews. The fact of the matter is it did not happen. Many Jews died. Millions died in World War II. It was chaotic. It was calamitous. But yeah, the official Holocaust narrative of 6 million Jews having died in gas chambers using Zyklon B is not only false, it's refutable on the basis of scientific reasoning.
Well, exactly. We have to be able to look into these questions, of course, and I think it's good that people do, no matter what initially some of the consequences for this might be. It's just too important to stay away from because so much hinge on this piece of history. And as you say, the consequent behavior, what we see happening in Palestine and even, as you rightly say, in Europe as well, this extortion of sorts of guilt and allowing this. And just look at the money question in itself. Countless money. And United States, who fought to destroy the enemy that allegedly did all this, even they, to a certain extent, have to suffer, as Britain has done, which is very strange, isn't it?
You're absolutely right, Heinrich, and it's my feeling. This has always been my attitude about the Holocaust. If it was real, then serious research would support it. And if it was not, then the world deserves to know. Well, it's not, and the world does deserve to know.
Let's just talk about join in, Ola, please.
No, I just wanted to say that, Henrik, we did an almost 2-hour long interview very recently where we went into extreme details about the Holocaust just by using normal Farmer Brown logic. At least that's the way I see it. You look at the evidence, you go where it takes you. Wherever the truth will take you, you have to have the courage to go there. And when you go into this topic, it's just unreal how things does not add up at all. I mean, it does not make sense at all how these gas chambers were built. When you look at the construction of them, they did not work. They did not function the way we're being told. Like some blinker, they used diesel engines to gas people. You look at scientific proof, you cannot kill someone with diesel exhaust. You can get very sick and so on, but you won't die from it. And so it's just the chimneys to the gas chambers were not connected to the rooms where they said the gassing took place and so on. So it just doesn't match up. And after I did this, I was a bit nervous to do this interview,
right.
the last one, because I've seen other people go down. I get totally massacred when they go into this topic. But the response I've got from listeners have been absolutely overwhelming, where people have just said, my God, it's wonderful that you guys have the courage to go where very few other people go.
Mm.
And also because it will liberate us all, because this is being used as such a weapon against truth seekers in all different areas around this whole power structure that is trying to control the world today. And I'm about to leave for the Open Mind Conference in Amsterdam in a few days. And I'm going there, speaking about false flag operations and so on. I'm joined by some beautiful people who are also doing everything they can to expose the truth. And the media in Holland, I've just been told, have gone out big time saying that this is a big rally for anti-Semites.
Oh, really? There you go.
And Nazis and,
yeah,
and stuff like. And it's like, you know, that is the last thing. I don't even step on ants, you know. I can with respect and love to my fellow human being. I, you know, and so it's just totally absurd. But this is the weapon they hit you with as soon
exactly.
as you even point a finger. I'm not here to attack anyone. I'm here to see what is the truth. What is the truth? Because once again, it is being used as soon as somebody starts really digging in. To something, might it be 9/11 or other things? This thing, anti-Semite, comes up. What is that?
Yeah,
you know, it has nothing to do. We're looking for the truth.
Heinrich,
yeah.
Those who challenge the Holocaust narrative are invariably denounced as anti-Semites and as Holocaust deniers who are spreading hate speech. But anti-Semites disvalue or discount the value or worth of persons or their opinions on the basis of their religious orientation or their ethnic origins. None of us who have contributed to this book do that, which means that we are not anti-Semites. Hate speech can be defined as any speech, gesture, conduct, writing, or display, which is forbidden because it may incite violence or prejudicial action against or by a protected individual or group, or because it disparages or intimidates a protected individual or group. But we don't do that either. Unless accurately reporting the results of scientific research on a major historical event qualifies as hate speech, which means we face the choice of either not reporting the results of scientific research on a major historical event or risking being accused of hate speech. In sorting out some of the most complex and controversial issues of our time, especially this one, therefore, we take the stand that truth is preferable to mythology.
Well, there's that quote, right? The truth is only hate speech for those who hate the truth. And that's kind of
yeah.
And that's where we're at right now, you know, because obviously science doesn't matter, you know. I mean, it matters to those who want to know the truth, but it doesn't matter to people who need this to be in a certain way for things to click on the not only geopolitical level, but emotional level, etc. And that's why many people then don't look at the evidence and they don't look at where this leads you, because obviously there's, if a media rally is starting up in this way, there really isn't any defense against that, because they will never hear your side of the story. Thank God, though, we have the web, we can talk with each other, we can get this out. But what would you guys say to that in terms of trying to legitimize this question to the mainstream?
It reflects the Zionist domination of the media. Even in the Netherlands, I mean, this is disgraceful, but, you know, the insidious influence here of those who are promoting the Holocaust agenda is breathtaking in its scope. And we must learn to repudiate this propaganda source because it's ubiquitous. You would find similar claims, no doubt, in the New York Times or the Washington Post. You can get more truth from Pravda or Russia Today than you can in the major media in the United States today. It's an appalling situation, Heinrich, especially given that this country, meaning the United States, was founded on principles of free speech, a free press, you know, unfettered discussion, open exchange, and yet it has become a mere shadow of its former self. There was once a time, I think, when that was a great deal of freedom of speech, and we had genuine, bona fide investigative journalism, but it appears to be a figment of a distant past.
Well, exactly. And I would say at this stage, it's interesting because now it's gone so far so that it's come to one of these kinds of subjects where the media, I think, will never budge. The authorities, the official explanations will never budge, but that in itself lends itself to discrediting its own behavior. And I think that's one of the reasons why the media is kind of faltering in listenership, readership, viewership, all of that, that more and more people are seeking the answers elsewhere. Right?
Yes. Yes, we had a recent study here in the U.S. showing 55% of the American people prefer the alternative media to the mainstream media.
Yeah.
And the fact of the matter is, if anyone actually looks at the evidence, that's all I ask. Look at the evidence. This book is chock full of evidence, maps, drawings, photographs, diagrams, all the data you can possibly need. There's more than sufficient evidence to prove each of the key points toward which this book is devoted. I mean, there's just no room for doubt left about it. That no alternative position is reasonable once you look at all the evidence. So the challenge is to get people to look at the evidence, which is why the propaganda campaign is so vicious and comprehensive. They don't want anyone to look at the evidence. Think of something as trifling as a map of Auschwitz, Heinrich. If you look at a map of Auschwitz, you find it has all sorts of facilities that are inconsistent with it having been a center for extermination. It includes a hospital with OBGYN facilities, a woodworking shop for making furniture and artifacts, an area for the symphony to play, orchestra performance. It even has a brothel, Heinrich. I therefore had, you know, featured a photograph on the back cover of the book of the British football team at Auschwitz with the caption, "What? You didn't know there was a UK soccer team at Auschwitz?"
Yep, I saw the back cover, and that's the kind of information, of course, that people. I mean, the thing is, though, I feel anyway that the view that we've gotten is so unbalanced, so that when these kinds of tidbits of information that comes out, they leave you kind of in a shocked state almost of like what? Because this was the epitome of evil. This is the time when, you know, Satan incarnate visited the earth, and the good forces in the world had to come together to fight them to clear this out, so to speak. But when these kinds of things come up with the orchestras and swimming pools and football teams, and that's completely contradictory to what we've been told.
Yes, you're absolutely right, and it's just stunning the extent to which the quality of news coverage, not just in the U.S. but around the world, has deteriorated. So that is the alternative news source. It's like Press TV. I've probably given 100 interviews to Press TV or Al Jazeera or the Voice of Russia, for example. Voice of Russia recently interviewed Nathan Foulkes, who's a Hollywood producer-director, about the Boston bombing, where Nathan identified one of the key players wearing a cowboy hat as an actor he cast in one of his own films. His name was Carlos Arredondo. You can see footage of Carlos waiting around until it's his time to follow the script and become involved. You have smoke and you have bodies with missing body parts, but there is no blood. Lorraine Day, who was the head of trauma surgery for San Francisco General Hospital, has observed that's a physiological impossibility. The blood only shows up later, and it's fake blood, Hollywood blood. It came out of tubes. And, in fact, it's Nathan's opinion that it wasn't even an explosion that caused the smoke, that it was done by a smoke machine. And he, as a producer-director, is more knowledgeable about aspects of this than am I. And he observed that it's what's known as hyper-realistic filming, where you try to make a scene as realistic as possible so that you can expose, for example, inexperienced troops to what they might encounter in combat. But it's all fake. Nobody died at the Boston bombing. I published quite a lot about it, including on YouTube. I have both an introduction to Sandy Hook and to the Boston bombing. They're entitled the Real Deal Special Must-See Sandy Hook Update and the Real Deal Special Must-See Boston Bombing. And I recently interviewed the aunt of the two brothers who were accused, Marat Saranoff, and published an article on my blog and on Veterans Truth Network entitled "They Didn't Do It." Marat Saranoff blows apart the Boston show trial, where she demonstrates that even the footage of the boys at the marathon itself was fake because Tamerlan, the older brother, already had a beard, and yet he's clean shaven at the marathon. She sent me a photograph of him in bed with his cat. He's got a beard, a video from a gymnasium working out with Zoker. He's got a beard. A friend called him after the bombing was relieved. He hadn't been anywhere in the vicinity. They had dinner together that night. He had a beard. In the arrest footage, if it hasn't been fuzzied up, which they're doing, you can see he's still got a beard. In the photograph of his body lying lifeless, he has a beard. But he's clean shaven in the marathon footage. Not only that, but I involved an attorney at law, a former law professor who'd been both a prosecutor and a defense attorney, to review the case. And he pointed out that in the FBI indictment, in the formal indictment in court and in the FBI investigated report, they both state that the backpacks that exploded were black nylon backpacks. But neither of the brothers was wearing a black nylon backpack. In fact, those were being worn by Kraft International personnel, whom the alternative media zoomed in on already the night of the event and exposed them as having planted these backpacks that exploded. And where this means, according to the former professor, his name is John Remington Graham, that there wasn't even probable cause to arrest or indict them, much less to convict them in a court of law. And a third point made in that interview with Moret is that Tamerlan was, of course, found dead after the police had arrested him. I mean, how could his brother Zoker have possibly killed him by driving him over with an SUV, apparently Tamerlan's own vehicle, after the police had arrested him? But Americans are so slow at putting two and two together, they don't even appreciate that. Well, here he's arrested, and then he turns up dead. How could his brother have been responsible for his death? In fact, we have a witness who reported seeing the police drive over him three different times with what appears to have been his own vehicle. I mean, it's that outrageous. I lay all this out in that article, "They Didn't Do It," Moret Saranova blows apart the Boston show trial.
Excellent. Yeah, I mean, obviously there's a lot of questions about these events, and it's very important that we ask them and dedicate some time looking at them, you know, especially when people like yourselves have done a lot of research on it, and also especially considering how we are supposed to react or in what direction we should take, both geopolitically or surveillance-wise or responses to these kinds of things, and that's why it is important. But, gentlemen, we have much more to discuss, and I want to pick up in the second hour. Shortly here, we're going to take a break, but let us first give out some of the details, not only where people can get a copy of the book, and I suppose we didn't go to the moon either, and of course the other volumes in the same series, if you will. I also want to give you gentlemen time to mention the websites that you have out there, so you guys listening know where to go if you want to find out more. Let's begin with you, Jim. Give us the details about the book.
With the book, there are two sources now. There will be more in the future, but right now you can obtain copies of the book at CreateSpace. Just put in, "and we didn't go to the moon either," CreateSpace, and you'll find one opportunity to obtain it, and the other is at Amazon.com. And I suppose we didn't go to the moon either, Amazon.com, and you'll find it there too. And it's also listed under Ole's books because he was so crucial in its production. So it's all, those are three different places. In fact, remarkably, Amazon is giving a 10% discount. So the book, we priced it low, $18.95, to make it accessible to one and all. I mean, it's over 365 pages, just chock full of evidence, including an index, a contributors page, and all the rest that you'd expect. It's all there in a wonderful package with a marvelous cover. But Amazon is selling it for like $17 and a cent. I mean, it's remarkable to me that that's taking place, but I'm very pleased.
Yeah, they always manage to push down the price in some way. I've heard from so many authors, they don't know how they do that, but they do it somehow. But give us some of your websites as well, Jim.
Well, the key are going to be, I have a 9/11 website at 911scholars.org. I have an assassinationscience.com website. I have my personal blog, jamesfetzer.blogspot.com. And I am publishing also now, as I mentioned previously, at veteranstruthnetwork.com. So all of those are good places. Plus, I do the real deal. I do a new video show, just began this year, and we have over 60 two-hour video programs online, which you can find if you do a search on MBC, for Media Broadcasting Center, The Real Deal. And, you know, you should be able to find all 60 there one way or another. Also, you could go to webookyourshow.com and you'll find an archive for The Real Deal.
All right. We'll try to have as many of these links up as possible on our side, of course, folks. You can find them easily from ours. Ulla, let's share some of your details as well, your website, your books, and also tell us about the upcoming conference, if you have that URL and whatnot.
Okay, my website is lightonconspiracies.com, because that is what I really, really try to. I've devoted some 30 years of my life aiming the light at, into the darkness, the darkest of corners, and just follow the truth wherever it will take me. And so my website is lightonconspiracies.com, and then one of my books is Coup d'etat in slow motion. It is about the assassination of the Swedish Prime Minister Olof Palme, but with all the connection into the Iran-Contras scandal, into all the way back actually to the JFK assassination, the international illegal arms dealing, drugs, you name it. It's so entangled, the whole thing. And, well, that's about it. I just want to say that I feel honored to be part of this book project. There's some exceptional people in it. Some of them that haven't been mentioned yet. Sam Gardner is one. Jim Morris is another, and so on. And I just think that this is could be one part of a major step forward when it comes to revealing what is really holding the whole of humanity down in such a horrific way, and most, many, not even being aware of it. So I think this is a time to step up, you know, step into the role and expose what's going on.
All right, very good. We'll have those links up, and also I believe openmindconference.nl is the direct website for the upcoming event. It's on June 6th and 7th. So do check that out, folks. It's about here in a week, so we'll have this show up before that time, so you can have some opportunity if you're close by to drop by there. But all right, gentlemen, stay with us. We'll return after a short break, and then we'll pick up with more in the second hour. Well, as we pick up in the second hour, folks, we continue down the rabbit hole, if you will, and discuss Paul McCartney and the Beatles. Some very interesting information here that I didn't know about in regards to the speculations concerning his death and replacement in the band. We're going to get into details about not only how, but also why this occurred and the influence during the counterculture of the Beatles themselves. As we proceed in the members' hour, we also talk about other doubles that have been taken out as opposed to installed. Saddam Hussein, a very strange case, and also the fate of CIA asset Osama bin Laden, a.k.a. Tim Osman. We also managed to squeeze in some pretty interesting stuff about Jade Helm, together with Jim and Ola. They have some interesting information to share with us, and where this seems to lead as of right now. So don't miss the second hour, ladies and gentlemen, for much more. If you enjoy investigative and controversial radio, where the answers lead the way, where we do our utmost to dispel the mythmakers and get to the truth, no matter how painful it can be, then you'll enjoy what we have for you on redicemembers.com. Close to 1,000 programs on many different subjects that we've been circling and learning more and more and more about over the years. All the details and more information is available for you on redicemembers.com. So go there to sign up and tune in. But before we proceed here, let me tell you about some of our upcoming guests. Mark Hackard, Jonas Deyer, Sofia Smallstorm, Christopher Hell, and Veronica Clark, to name a few. But stay tuned now. We'll be right back after a break with Jim Fetzer and Ole Damegård. Thank you for listening.